Hey folks, it's Jeremy Kirkland. You're listening to Blammo. This is my podcast. It's about clothes and stuff with cool folks. So if you're new here, welcome. How's that for an intro? Look, I don't know if you're a big Blammo head, but remember when we called it the podcast with an exclamation point. Wah, wah, wah. Talk about don't look back. Onward, onward. So, this is where I'm going to make a joke about daylight savings time, right? Because everyone, we lost an hour. I hate daylight savings time. There's the joke. It's dumb. But we're not talking about that. We're here to have fun. We're here to talk about fashion. We're here to talk about culture. We're here to talk about, all the good stuff. I feel like this is where, if DJ Khaled was here, he'd be my wingman, or I'd be his wingman, whatever. Has anyone been watching Shogun? That's the most important thing. It's on FX. If you haven't been, you're missing out on some of the best television. It's really, really good. Folks are chatting about it in the Slack. It's set in Osaka, Japan in the 1600s. It's incredible. And surprise, my guest this week is one of the writers, Emily Yoshida. As an aside, Emily is one of my favorite people in the entertainment industry. She was previously a writer and critic at Vulture and New York Magazine. And she's here. And she joins us to chat the new series, Shogun, eBay finds, getting into Grand Seiko, and more. It's all in there. Let's do it. Okay, so what are you doing in Iowa? Are you from there? Did you move there? What's the word?
I am from here. I use that term lightly. I went to junior high and high school here. Mm-hmm. But those are the important years, right? I mean, I spent my childhood in the Pacific Northwest, but I just kind of bonded with Iowa more, I guess. So I hadn't been here in a while because my mom moved away from here a long time ago. So I stopped coming back for holidays, but I spent some time here during COVID, during the 2020 part of COVID, and
yeah,
kind of fell back in love with it. So, and then got, I kind of say I had a a mental lapse where I was like, I must have a home in Iowa. But I'm happy about it. It's just been a crazy struggle. It's been one of the most difficult things I've tried to do in my life. So, yeah.
Do you mean living in two places or leaving LA?
Both things. I do still have an apartment in LA and I'm going to be back out there this spring. I'm planning on keeping it and just subletting it when I'm not there. As long as that makes sense. But no, it's the house. I got a freaking farmhouse that they say was built in 1910. Who knows when it was actually built, but it's old and it's in good condition. I looked at a lot of places that were not in as good a condition, but it's just, it's a project. I'm making a whole new kitchen. I'm doing real HGTV type stuff that I truly, and I am someone who up until that point had never even had an apartment with a patio, let alone a yard, like a garden and, what do they call them? I almost said outhouses, outbuildings. They're called outbuildings. But I just tried to do the thing and I'm learning a lot and it's been a growth experience and I've definitely gotten some more gray hairs, but my hair's bleached right now, so nobody can tell.
Yeah, we did the same. We moved. So I'm from St. Louis originally, but it's the same thing in which, I went to high school here. I moved to New York, eons ago and was there for a long time. And then during COVID, we moved, bought a house. And I think one of the interesting things is nothing gets people more excited than any sort of home renovation because we got the house. And of course, we were we're going to redo our kitchen. We're going to there was a leak in the foundation and all this stuff. And so I was putting it on social media, as any idiot would in my case. Mm-hmm. And I was just putting it on there and people, it was like the freaking Summer Olympics. Everyone's just what's happening with the house? What's happening today? How are you doing this? And I'm man, everyone in America loves home reno. Everyone eats it up. You learn a lot about yourself when you're figuring out what type of granite to use or whether you should knock down a wall and why I don't know how to do anything with drywall.
Getting stalled out on something like grout I'm like, wow, I never even thought about this. Like, why is this such a part of my identity now? It's so cringy. Like, I hate being that person. Like, I would like to share stuff on social media. I wish I had the bug mm-hmm. anymore to share that kind of thing. Cause this little stuff I have shared, people are like, oh, wow, looks so cool. Oh my God, you're living mm-hmm. the dream. I am definitely not living the dream right now. I haven't had a shower. Like, I haven't had a place to bathe in my house for, like, I came back out here in August and I still don't really have a functional shower. I've had to use the gym and I've had to use my boyfriend's house. so like, I'm not like, I don't ever want to sugarcoat things or try to do the Instagram thing where you make it look, you know, more glamorous than it is.
Right.
But I just, I don't know. It's something it has been such a traumatic experience that I don't have the thing of like, I must share this with a bunch of strangers. Like, it's been quite painful and difficult. But, you know, I'm also looking forward to having things done and just showing that part and being like, it was magic. It only took 2 years. It was so easy. You know, don't show the painful, miserable part of it.
Yeah. Well, you've been writing and stuff, though, during this time, right?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't writing during the strike. I hope you're not implying that.
No. I was not implying that. But just like you know, before you were writing for TV and film and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, because what you were you at The Verge first or were you at Vice or...
I was at The Verge. The Verge was my first New York media job. And I went there from Grantland, which was an LA-based job. I basically was working editorial jobs. Like, I was editors and managers, that kind of thing. Until I started working for New York Mag, Vulture, all that. And that was like the first I got to be just a writer, which is funny. I think some people think of the opposite thing as being the upgrade. But to me, it was just like, oh, cool. I don't have to wake up at 6 and answer Slacks and like manage a zillion writers. I love editing, but like I took a like 50% pay cut to just a film critic. And it was like so worth it to me. I was a much happier person once I was kind of out of the editing game. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause is it because you get to focus more on your own voice and your own sort of thoughts versus that makes sense.
Yeah. And like, you know, I was still doing stuff like, you know, going to festivals and covering stuff, but then it was just about me writing and not about me thinking about a section strategy for Sundance or something like that. Like, you know, I could just sort of be on my own little journey and have the confidence to just, you know, just share my own dumb opinions about movies that like 50 people see.
It's a little more than 50.
It was really a turning point for me, and that ultimately led to me being able to get, you know, into the TV world because I had time to work on stuff outside of, you know, my jobby job. So, yeah, it was, I think I spent about 10 years altogether in what I refer to loosely as the media, but that I'm not in media now, but I don't know how else to describe it. It's like, I was a web writer. Like, that's like, I don't know. I was in print a few times, but for the most part, I was like writing for the internet, and it's very hard to find like a cool way to put that, but I was a film critic, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's funny because I have a few other friends who write, you know, who are like a movie reviewer, critic, whatever word we want to use. And like people are always like, oh, like it's a little bit pejorative in the sense that they're just like, oh, like it's less than. But as a person, I mean, what, I'm 38. Yeah. And I spend a ton of time on the internet. I read tons of different reviews and critic reviews. I read that and interact with like those writers far more than, I don't know, than whatever sort of highbrow mentality someone thinks than like a New Yorker person or anything like that. Like, it's just, it's, and I feel like I'm more connected to those. Like, perfect example, your letterbox, right? Your letterbox
I've had like 4 reviews on there, but yes, go on.
Well, I mean, we can pull up your numbers and all the people that follow you, but like the stuff that's in there, I think it's really interesting. You get this view of people's, of like what people actually like. Cause like I have this stupid theory that because the internet, there's so much stuff and there's so much noise and things out there that the only thing people really like to cling to now is like anything that's empathetic. And so when someone specifically, like someone like you, or a writer, or someone who's known for a very specific medium or type of writing, all of a sudden shares other parts of themselves, you know, to jump back to like your house, there's like a new level for all of your fans and other people to connect with you on. And now there's this like empathetic connection into which it's like, oh, she's working on her bathroom, or, oh, you know what? She also likes these weird Disney movies or this anime thing that I've always loved, or whatever that is. Like, I think that that becomes this new sort of like connection that I think in some cases, like on your side, like it can amplify your writing and make you feel like more secure and more excited to take risks, or it can make people a little bit more reclusive. I'm curious how that might have like evolved for you.
I mean, I do feel a little reclusive now. I'm not really on social media except for Instagram. And I oftentimes just fully forget to even check it. And it's weird. Like I've had an interesting past year, like just in terms of work and being online. I mean, everybody did who was in striking last, you know, I think a lot of people. It was a year of realizing things as
Kardashian,
I can't remember her name.
Jenner would say.
It's Kylie. It was Kylie. Okay. Mrs. Timothy Chalamet. but I mean I did kind of I quit Twitter. I was on Twitter private. Like I had kind of officially quit Twitter a while ago, but then I for good, you know, put it out of my life. And I do miss a lot of things about it. I mean, there's a lot of people say who've had to quit. Like, you know, I was on there for a really long time. I met friends. I met real, real friends off of there. I got jobs off of there. I built a persona of whatever that means on there. And cutting that off, you know, when I first did, I was like cutting off an arm or something. But yeah, like I have really, I guess, as in a very online way of putting it, I have been trying to touch grass more, which is easy to do in the Midwest, I guess. And especially where I am, you know, genuinely in a rural spot. But it's been a very interesting time, you know, and it's part of like a long process, I think, after leaving the media again, I say with scare quotes, because one of the biggest things I had to get used to just in the first year of being a TV writer was just the lack of response of your work to your work. Like, obviously, you're right. You know, you're getting notes from your fellow writers if you're in a room, or from a network if you're writing a pilot or whatever the case may be. But the audience response, I didn't realize how much that was kind of part of the engine that kept me writing. Like it's insane. Shogun is coming out. I don't know when this is going to go live. Shogun is, I guess this is a plug, on FX plug and Hulu away. And Disney Plus on February 27th, I believe. And I was writing on that show in late 2019. That's how long it has taken for this thing to come out. I am a completely different person right now than I was in 2019. This is
so
pre-COVID.
Was it LA Yoshida at that time then? This is
I just come back out to I just come back out to LA for this job. I left New York in the summer of 2019, came back out to LA where I had lived there for like 10 years and then was in New York for like 5 years and like about 1 year into living in New York, I was like, how do I get back to LA? I'm just more of an LA person in general. But yeah, so I'd come back. It was like, cool. I've got my dream job. Everything's working out. And then COVID hit. And then, you know, I mean, whatever. Nothing has been normal since then. But and that was part of the reason that, you know, the show took so long to produce. And in the interim, I kind of like transparency about this stuff because I don't think a lot of people know like how absurd this stuff is sometimes. But, you know, I'm sitting here in a house that I bought off of money that I made working for television. And the first show that I worked on is coming out in a month, like in a month, like more than 4 years after, like just about 4 years to the day since we ended The Room.
How common is that? Because I feel like some stuff goes a little bit faster. Like my buddies that worked on The Bear, yeah. I mean, you know, you wrote and taped and yeah. filmed whatever, and that was out earlier. Was it just because of like, I mean, the show looks pretty, I mean, I saw the trailers. Oh, it looks intense.
Yeah. It's a huge production. It's, I won't throw out any numbers, but because I don't know what the end kind of total was, but it's quite. Sure. Quite expensive, you know, Game of Thrones type scale. And I think it's all on the screen. I've seen a handful of episodes locked, final cut, like effects and everything. And then I've seen a lot of like rough cuts before. But, you know, like everything is on the screen. Like it was a huge, huge wow. thing. So, yeah, I mean, that's part of it. But, you know, I think it's both of those are FX shows. It's funny. But I think depending on where people see the show fitting into the schedule for the year, the overall strategy for the platform or whatever, I think that has a lot to do with it. I also just, I mean, yeah, like The Bear is probably, I've worked with some folks who also worked on The Bear as well. And I just, you know, I just think it's like a little bit of a lighter weight thing to do. I'm not, but that has nothing to do with the quality of the writing, the quality of the show or anything. I love The Bear. And yet, like, they got out 2 seasons in between the time yeah. that this, yeah, I think our show is unusually, it was an unusually long ride from Room to, and just Room, like, you know, they'd been developing it longer than that. But still, it's a slower art form. It's a slower mode of writing. It's slower. I mean, I consider myself a kind of fast writer. So I get very impatient when, you know, I've finished a draft and that it's like, wait 3 months for notes or whatever. It's just a very big, slow. It depends on that. I mean, I've been on some good and bad projects.
You know, it's interesting because, yeah, I mean, I have other friends who have worked on TV and film and all sorts of other stuff where there's not really anything that's kind of like air quote normal anymore. So right. you yeah. have stuff like South Park into which they're writing up until, you know, less than 24 hours to go.
Yeah.
And then you also have, you know, shows like that, what you worked on, which because is it historical fiction or it's historical nonfiction?
Yeah, it's based on historical events. You know, there's some stuff that's fudged a little bit, but the three main leads are all based on real characters who were a part of this, you know, very specific pivotal part of Japanese history. So, right. Yeah. So, and it's very, you know, they were really, really trying to get everything right historically, yeah. detail wise. I think it was a very painstaking process. I should also say that I am hosting, I guess. It's all in the can, so it's past tense to me, but
sure.
the Shogun, the official podcast, which will be coming out every week, you know, right after each episode airs. And it's a lot of behind the scenes details, talking to the actors and special effects people and costume people and all that. So it's funny because I wasn't really involved in any of the production or post-production or anything, but I got to learn about a lot of it from doing the show. So yeah, I really got a window into just how much work went into this thing. And it's pretty mind-boggling. I hope people watch it because there are just like maybe close to 1,000 people who were involved in this and put a lot of like love and care into it. So
I'm super amped. I mean, I love that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm someone whom, you know, like, don't judge me too harshly, where it was like, I discovered Kurosawa like maybe, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. And then
it's
I didn't really get anything. I didn't really get anything. And then I watched like Dreams. And then mm-hmm. I had to go listen to like 4 or 5 different podcasts to have people explain what was actually going on. And then, you know, jump in a few group chats of like movie friends that were trying to, you know, enlighten me further. And I think it's interesting that like the era of TV and movie and then like podcasts in conjunction with it, because mm-hmm. especially, you know, like the Game of Thrones pods that were going on at that time. And I think like Boardwalk Empire had a pod at one point, and it helps you get super excited for the show because you get to feel like you know these things that other people don't. And then yeah. more importantly, like there's just only so much a show can do to like create the world and the tension and the environment. And so like when you know, I'm excited for it too. Cause like when you get to hear that and you're like, well, this was that big of a deal because culturally X, Y, and Z. And you're like, oh, well, they couldn't show all of that in a show. Cause one, it would look tacky if they pause and be like, hey, no. Do you know why this is a big deal? But I think like that stuff is so important now. And it makes me like wish, like, man, I wish there were more like pods for, you know, like Columbo or, you know, Poirot or all these other things that like, yeah, this was a big deal in the 1930s when, you know, Hercule Poirot did this and this.
Oh my God. I would die for that for Poirot. I mean, I would die for that for Columbo as well, especially with all the LA stuff that like,
right?
You know,
yeah.
I could really geek out on that. But yeah. All the costume. I am a Poirot. Like that was part of my upbringing. So that would be great.
Sounds like you grew up around. Well, you said you were in Portland, but if you were in the Midwest, like me, we would go to the library. We would rent movies, and so it was Poirot and Fawlty Towers. Which, you know, because also you could rent a lot of Monty Python stuff, which at the time, like now as a parent, like I'm not sure that was probably the most appropriate thing for like, you know, a 10-year-old kid to throw on. But
I mean, and clearly it ruined your life.
Yeah, it did.
You seem like a complete disaster because of Monty Python. So, no, I think that's great. I love the library.
It's so, well, no, it's me too. I mean, it definitely all the Masterpiece Theater, all the Poirot stuff, especially because that show, for folks who don't know, it's Agatha Christie's Poirot and Hercule Poirot, who's the detective, is played by the same actor for every single one of the Poirot books. And I think it took them like 30 years to do all of them. I mean, obviously there were gaps, but like David Suchet is Poirot. He's the OG.
Yeah. He's like, what's his face? He's like Wolverine. He's like, you know, like he just owns he's like Hugh Jackman for Wolverine. He just owns the character. There's no other Poirot. And then, you know, when there has been recent different Poirots, you're just like, this isn't right. This is not.
It's also like that TV is good because I feel like it's low stakes. And even though it's something that like is someone's life and death, you know, you're not like the world isn't about to end at every episode or anything like that. It's like, oh, man, I was on vacation and this fucking guy died in the room. Like, now we got to figure this out. Now my vacation's ruined, you know, but it's so good.
It's interesting, though, because it's like, yeah, it's not. I agree. It's like very chill TV, like the aesthetics, just the way in which it's shot is just very calming to me. Probably also just because of childhood stuff. It's got some Pavlovian, you know, I have some Pavlovian just calming sense that comes over me when I'm watching it. But like, it is interesting to think about it as an adult and like knowing a few things and like, you know, this is all like just post World War One, like people, which felt like the end of the world at the time. Yeah. And then you're like, oh, a little murder in somebody's parlor is nothing. like all the sons of this, you know, village just died, you know, like, and then, you know, somebody got poisoned at somebody's dinner party. Like, you know, it all comes out in the wash. We're just going to wear fantastic outfits and move on. Like,
yeah, I feel like Poirot wouldn't exist today, based on like the stakes of it and that there's not a ton of stuff that moves it forward.
Yeah.
Like you're not like, oh man, I can't wait for next week when blank happens. It's just like, he's still the world's greatest detective, you know, no shots fired, but maybe like, I'm not a huge fan of the Poirot remakes of, of Kenneth Branagh's stuff. I'm David Suchet land.
Yeah.
So
yeah, no, sure no, no good. Hate for Kenneth Branagh at all, but it's just, once you're used to something, it's hard to, that's just our guy.
Did you work on Poker Face? Or, you know, you
I didn't work
poker
on Poker Face.
Face.
I was in Poker Face. I made my television acting debut on Poker Face or streaming or whatever you want to say.
Yeah. Because that I felt like was the best, like made me think of Poirot stuff again.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, like, Ryan was definitely obviously inspired by Columbo and stuff like that as well. And I think, like, it is tricky. Like, there has to be some sort of suspended reality, I think, now to pull off something like that that takes place in the present day. You know, you have to kind of set it in a heightened place so that something like a murder doesn't feel actually, like, you know, like you don't think too hard about who got murdered and why and like, you know, what is this horrible world that we're living in where somebody can get murdered in cold blood. You know, it's just a device to start a a game, basically, in the context of the show. And I think, like, and it is harder to do in a present day set thing. But I think I don't know. It seems like people really liked Poker Face a lot. Feels like it pulled it off.
Oh my God. It was, it was probably my favorite show of,
it was really
fun. I don't
know
what year it came out, but whatever year it came out, that was my favorite.
Me neither. I guess it came out last year. I think it came out about a year ago, because I remember going to the premiere, which would have been like in spring or something. Yeah.
How did you get hooked up with Ryan Johnson?
We met ages ago. He came on a podcast that I used to host at Grantland. So like really a long time, like over 10 years ago. And we just kind of stayed in touch after that and just were buds. And then, I don't know. He just was like, hey, want to be in the show? And I was out here that summer and I was like, yeah, sure. Like I'll exit my Midwestern cave to go and act opposite Natasha Lyonne. Yeah, sure. But it was fun. It was a lot of fun. I've been really, trying to put the bug in his ear that Murder Girl, the character that I played, was a podcast host. It's also kind of, I feel like it was a little bit of like an inside jokey thing just because I'm like on so many podcasts and then my line on television is like, I'm a podcaster. <You know? laughs> But I hope she can make a return in season two, which they are doing. So,
Oh, hell yeah. That's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember meeting, so Ryan Johnson, I used to work at Beggars Group, and Ryan Johnson did a video, this is pre all the Star Wars, all the other stuff, for John Darnielle's Mountain Goats album, The Life of the World to Come, and they filmed in a church, and it was just him performing, and like they had a, what is it with like when the camera's on a dolly or something, maybe that's what it was.
Like a dolly, like it's on a track or something?
Yeah, it was like on a track around the piano, and it was oh, really cool. Beautiful, and Ryan Johnson had filmed it, and he came into the office, and I think at the time, I don't know if Looper had been out yet, but basically everyone just wanted to talk to him about Brick. And John Darnielle was like, yeah, let's talk about Brick. Even though like we're there to watch this like, movie they did of John Darnielle performing the album. But it was just like people just nerded out about Brick with him. And he was the freaking coolest, most down to earth guy ever.
That movie is so special. It's just like I remember seeing that with a friend of mine from high school who also ended up living in the LA area, like when it came out, and we hadn't hung out for a long time. And then we went to go see Brick together. I don't know why. Like it was like, we just had this random friend date to do it. And then we like came out of it and we're like, this is like the movies we used to try to make in high school, but good. Like with a budget. Cause we used to like do all sorts of kind of, this sort of heightened high school type story where, people are getting murdered and people are talking like they're, Philip Marlowe or whatever. It was just so much fun. It felt like it captured something that I feel like exists in a lot of young people's heads where they're like, I know I'm 17, but actually I'm like a grizzled 40-year-old who chain smokes.
I was more stuck in the Animorphs world where I just kind of hope my friends and I could turn into animals and go save the day.
How late into your youth were you reading Animorphs? Just curious.
I'm busted. I don't know. I think I liked Lord of the Rings, and my parents were like, if you want to read fantasy, read Lord of the Rings. And I read it and I was like, all these fucking names aren't even real. Like this, I can't read this because I don't know how like Dingle Dop and the Bingle Bong. And I was like, I can't handle any of this stuff. And then I was reading Goosebumps and Hardy Boys. And then I was like, forget this. Sega Genesis is here. And so I took a big break. And then I think my little brother had Animorphs. And I was like, oh, this seems kind of cool. What's Tobias up to? This guy who's like a hawk and he's stuck as a hawk. And I was like, that seems kind of dope.
I love that was like Lord of the Rings was too nerdy for you. And then you're like,
they weren't real words. I was like, my mom was like, oh, well, Tolkien was a linguist. You know, he wrote a language first and then he made the books to fit the language.
Kids love that. That's how you sell it to a kid.
And I was like, whatever, mom, give me Tobias.
Oh my God.
Wait, hold on a second. Okay, before you send that DM or text that friend, I know what you're thinking. You're ready to buy your first serious watch. Or in other cases, maybe your fourth or your fifth. But look, man, it's hard out there. It really is. from this dealer or that store that wants the purchase history or whatever. I mean, you're just, I don't know, you're almost ready to walk away from the whole game. But fear not, my friends. Check out Bezel. Bezel is the trusted marketplace for buying and selling your next luxury watch, with expert in-house authentication on every purchase. With over 18,000 watches listed right now, as of the time I'm recording this, from a mix of professional dealers to private sellers, you're just going to find what you're looking for. But wait, wait, I know. You're like, Jeremy, I'm sorry. They don't have that X Rolex or that insane Omega. Well, reach out to them. Bezel has a real team of real people. Just create an account and be connected with a private client advisor, and they will guide you through the entire process every step. Once you decide on your watch, it's overnighted to Bezel HQ, where their in-house team of experts authenticate it, and then it's on your way to you. If anything is amiss, the watch is not listed correctly, whatever it is, they'll let you know, the buyer know, and the offer to refund you or source you a new one at a similar price. That's pretty good, right? This has been part of the Bezel ethos since launch. I've even spoke to the founders about it. And now you can make an offer on a watch, buy it outright, or bid it at auction. Bezel is the highest rated watch marketplace out there. Even Trustpilot shows Bezel is 4.9 out of 5 stars with rave reviews. Okay, you're still on the fence? Dig into the Blammo feed yourself and listen to my chat with the Bezel co-founders and, well, see for yourself. But you got this. I believe in you. Visit getbezel.com and buy and sell your next luxury watch. That's getbezel.com. Getbezel.com. So wait, you said you were making movies in high school?
Yeah, I loved making little movies. I mean, I went to, like, I've been like wanting to do this as long as I could breathe, I guess, you know, working in TV and movies and stuff. But I think from my sophomore year to my senior year, I was in charge of the City High Film Festival in Iowa City, Iowa, which was like our student film festival that we held in like our big auditorium. Which was kind of like, the school I went to looks really, really cool. It looks very like, you know, it's very grand and sort of a way mm-hmm. they don't build high schools anymore. So the auditorium was like quite fancy looking, you know, it was a very glamorous occasion. And we would screen all these, you know, little short vampire films and mystery films that people just made in their backyards and stuff. And it was a lot of fun that I made. I did a couple films for it. The one I did in my senior, I love that I'm talking about this like it's my filmography, but.
Oh, this is fantastic.
The last one I did was called Vamos, like as in go, like go.
Got him.
It was about, it was the last night of the world. That's all anybody kept saying. It was the last day before the world ended. And it was just me. I really kind of cobbled it together. It was very Jarmusch-y in retrospect. I kind of just cobbled together these conversations between my friends. Like I would go to their houses and they would sort of play themselves and just have these weird little vignettes of what people were doing in the last night of the world. And I remember it was very moody and absurd. And I actually was thinking about that recently, and I was like, man, in some ways you just never change. Like in some ways you're just always interested in the same tones and amused by the same things. But yeah, I love making little, it was like when, you know, like the iMac was just out and you could do iMovie and it was like relatively easy to just edit things on a computer. I did do a little bit of the, you know, the two video recorders editing thing because we had one of those at the school as well. But once we got the iMacs in, it was just like, it's over. Like, I'm just gonna, you know, rent out the little mini DV cams as often as I can and just try to make little stupid things.
You had your FireWire hub.
Oh, yeah. Oh, RIP FireWire.
Yeah, man, that was dope. I remember those times. My friends and I, we made videos too, but it wasn't like the Channel 101 sort of world that it looks like you guys were living in over there, making like feature things. We tried to make funny stuff and it was just, I mean, it was dumb. It was like people like sitting on whoopee cushions, you know, I mean, think 14, 15 year old boy.
Yeah. I think a lot of people were very inspired by Jackass at that time. Like, I don't think like, like our world was not, it wasn't like we were making feature films. There was a lot of just like dumb fuckery happening. Yeah. But I think that stuff was so influential. It just like, in, it, like, or it made it feel like there was a low barrier to like an excuse to turn on a video camera, which of course now there's no barrier at all. But at that time it felt like, you know, let's just, you know, fuck around on skateboards in the backyard or like, you know, I don't know. Just, it felt very, yeah, accessible.
Yeah. Well, also it was, at least for me, it was the first time other than America's Funniest Home Videos that you saw low quality video on like capital T TV to where you were like, oh, maybe this video that we're making could turn us into, you know, rock stars, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. But that's, I live for that, that sort of era. One thing I wanted to dive into, though, on especially on like things like Shogun and other stuff, do you think that it's like more exciting to write about eras that you haven't lived in versus now so many things like a cell phone just solves the problem?
Well, that's such a special case, that book. And it was also, we were working off of a novel. So a lot of that stuff was sort of figured out for us. I do like not bringing phones and stuff into stuff that is even set now. Like I am working on a project right now that is extremely ambitious. I'm working on it with a musician. It's kind of her concept, but it takes place in a world that is like technically like 30 years in the future from now. But in this world, they've just decided like we don't have the internet. Like the internet is toxic and it caused strife and discord, and we're just gonna, you know, put an end to it. And it's just like this community that, so it feels sort of like, it feels kind of 90s in it, but you know, the there is a generation of characters in it who did live, like they are technically like they're millennials who are now like older in it, and so they know, you know, they're familiar with that sort of exchange of ideas, and you know, very, some of them are very glad that we've moved on, and others are trying to get back on Twitter, back on X.
Yeah, no, I feel like, especially, and it's because, you know, I love watching things like Poirot, and even, I don't know, and a lot of it's just like for me, like going on Letterboxd and finding other movies and stuff where I'm like, oh man, like the fact that phones aren't really in this, I'm more interested. To where it's like, someone posted something and it was like, Home Alone in 2024, and it was like a text, like, Mom, you left me here. And it's like, sorry, and that was it. And I'm just like, yeah, you're right. Like there's so much... There's so much stuff. It's like, not having that like constant connectivity, I think it just lets problems be created that otherwise would have been circumvented by a phone. I don't know. I think
though that you can create some problems and never would have existed with a phone. With the phone, like I am also working. I'm working on a lot of things right now. I'm working on another original pilot that is completely dependent. It takes place more or less in one location. Like it's pretty bound to one location, but the entire plot is enabled by the fact that one character is live streaming, and that basically creates a problem that snowballs and becomes completely ridiculous over the course of, you know, the season. And it's funny because I wrote this character to kind of be, she doesn't do this. Like she's not an influencer. She's never really messed with this. So she's kind of discovering it for the first time of like, wow, if I do this, like people respond this way. And it kind of, I mean, cause it's honestly how I would be if I was, if I decided to be an influencer today, I'd be like, wait, like, you know, what can I do to get hearts? You know, I would be very, very elementary at it. But yeah, I think, I mean, it's, there are different opportunities for, you know, a tech free story and one that is very tech heavy. And I think just thinking around it and thinking about how you'll use it in a way that it's not just like feels fresh, but feels indispensable to the plot and not a band-aid or like an easy fix, but like integrating technology or connectivity or whatever into the story, like to make it, like make it mean something in the context of a story.
Yeah, I feel like the first season of Sherlock did a really good job of
phones and texts.
Right. That was so like revolutionary that you could make
the bubbles
texting
on the screen
visual. Yeah. And now I feel like, I mean, whatever, that's probably like kind of hack now, but it was, I think it opened up because, you know, there was just such an idea for a long time that like you just couldn't show somebody typing on a computer. It was just like a, like, death on screen. And now obviously there's, you know, we have to find ways around it if you're telling a modern story. And I think like that was kind of one of the first really notable ways you saw people attempting it and making it exciting and making it not feel like just people looking at their phones, because obviously a lot of drama can play out when you're just looking at your phone.
Do you ever get lost in like the TikTok stuff of now? Like, I mean, how good are you with your screen time?
I am too good with my screen time. Like I was saying, I've really been on a Luddite kick and I need to find a way to get back, because I'm getting to the point where I'm missing. I don't care about missing whatever who the main character was on Twitter that day or something. Like I really genuinely don't miss that stuff. And when I hear about it from people, I'm just like, oh, OK, like shrug. Like, I mean, my life is not impacted by me not knowing about. I shouldn't mention Bean Dad because I actually know Bean Dad personally, but like, you know, that kind of thing. but yeah, I don't have TikTok. I've never been on TikTok. I you know, which immediately makes you, I guess, not in tune with the conversation. But I have to say that making the transition to being a creative person versus a person who is online for a living, which is a lot of gray area in between. But like, I actually am getting to the point where even though it's sort of frustrating sometimes to feel out of the loop, I actually see it. I tell myself at least that it's a competitive advantage, that like I will write differently and than other people by virtue of what I'm surrounding myself with every day and what I choose and not to choose to watch. I am very, like, in the same way, I'm very protective of my TV watching time, which often leads to really awkward generals where people are like, what are you watching right now? I'm like, I don't know, nothing. I don't know. I just watched the Lord of the Rings trilogy for the 16th time, like, which I did. But I am a Libra, so I am very I'm very sticky with language and with anything I watch, I take in and I internalize in some way and oftentimes end up imitating without realizing it. So I think that bad writing and lazy writing is contagious, and I try to keep myself away from it. So, which is, you know, easier said than done, and often leads to me missing things too. I really rely on my friends and people, you know, luckily I have a lot of friends who watch like everything, so they can tell me what's good. But yeah. But also I will say, just to add on to that, it's like, I never have encountered or worked with people who were bigger haters about TV than TV writers and about movies as well. Like, film critics and TV critics, almost by nature, I've given this speech to my friends so many times before. By nature, they have to be kind of rah-rah about the medium because they need to justify their jobs in covering it. And I say this as somebody who did this for a living and really felt myself pulling punches on a lot of things that I just didn't have the time of day for. But it's just like, well, everybody else says this is good, so I shouldn't like say what I really think, which I regret, like, totally. But then, you know, you can burn a lot of bridges also doing that. It's just a whole other tangent about the pluses and minuses of how people cover media now. But I think that people who are working in it, and I mean, that's probably a lot of different reasons for it, but I think, you know, there is sort of a narcissism of small differences with when you see bad writing on TV and you are a TV writer, because you can kind of see how it got bad. And I think people are less forgiving of that. Like, it's more, you know, and it's also competitive and whatever, blah, blah, blah. But I think there's less of a reason to defend bad writing when you are a TV writer.
No, first of all, I'm really glad you said that, because that was actually one of the points I wanted to make. Like, I have a bunch of friends that all work in TV and film, and the only stuff that they watch, and, you know, this is somewhat of a generalization, but it's kind of true. It's mostly true, is they only watch things when they're like researching, you know, Or you watch this stuff because everyone told you to watch it, where it's like, all right, 10 other people told me I had to watch this movie. Fine, I'll watch it. And because, you know, the going into the experience of it, you're like, well, all these people said it's great. I guess I need to think it's great. And so you're already a little bit like against it. Like, perfect example. I watched the new, well, it's not new anymore, but I watched the most recent Mission Impossible. And it is one of the most tire fire films I've ever seen in terms of story. And I was like, this movie.
I haven't heard that expression before. Is that a bad thing? Is a tire fire a bad thing?
Well, a tire fire basically like, it can't, you can't put out a bunch of burning rubber. It takes a long time. It's horrible. You don't want a tire fire. It's bad. And I was like, this movie sucks. And before, you know, before someone clips this out or someone like DMs me and says like, no, like I get it. The action scenes are amazing. It's so incredible. Sure. Tom Cruise is such a superhero and how he can do X, Y, and Z. But I'm just like, the fact that it's literally Tom Cruise against AI is just, and there's a person like this sentient sort of being who's like in touch with the AI. I'm just like, this is so bad. And and I have all these other friends who's like, well, one of my best friends like worked on some of the special effects and it's just one of the best movies ever. It set a new standard. And I'm like, but it's bad. But like the story isn't, you know, and I feel like there's this weird sort of thing that exists. And a bunch of people in the industry listen to this who are going to probably come at me. But like, like it's kind of like empty. And I think like that stuff ends up distracting from things like, I don't know, from like something that's like on Masterpiece, you know, whether it's like All Creatures Great and Small, which is like
All Creatures Great and Small. Oh my God. The softest like show of all.
Yeah, exactly.
The like, original soft boy.
Yeah. Show me you're a good writer by like creating tension in a village where nothing matters versus AI is going to take over the world. And I think like there's stuff there. And I remember having this conversation with my friend and he's like, how often do you eat junk food? Like, how many times, like, do you just want to go get, like, a cheeseburger? He's like, you have to understand that, like, all these things apply in the industry. And, like, you should just chill out. I was like, well, okay. Well,
but I hate when people say that, like, comparing it to junk food. Because it's like, well, now you're just discounting the work of all these people who spent years on the effects and the stunts and all that. And that's like real work. And I understand if you're an effects person or a stunts person, especially, I mean, like whatever, like a layman can appreciate it too. And you're like, wow, I really see this is quite an achievement. Like I want to go see this on a big screen and like, you know, I'll be excited about it. I don't think that needs to be everybody though. But I don't think that makes it like, I just think you can't have it both ways. Like you can't just, I don't believe in the thing of like guilty pleasure really either. I think you just like stuff. Like if things are good, they're good. And I think you have to, if you like something like, I didn't see Dead Reckoning, but like if you like a Dead Reckoning, you got to be prepared to defend it as like a good thing and not junk food, you know? And if you can't do that, then maybe it's not good.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. And it's tough too, because like one of my best friends loves Avatar and he loves James Cameron and he thinks James Cameron is like one of the greatest. And I'm, you know, I like Terminator, I guess. That's about it.
I think James Cameron is one of the greatest, but I have no time for Avatar. I missed the boat on the first one and I will never catch Avatar fever. I didn't see the second one. So I'm just like, I'm sure it's a lot of fun. I haven't been there. And I probably won't go. It's kind of like Australia to me. I'm like, I'm sure it's great, but I don't know if I'm ever going to go there in my life. But I believe
to Pandora,
everybody.
When
they
say it's
great. Yeah, to Pandora. I haven't. But I do think, I talk all the time about Titanic. I don't know. I feel like that and Lord of the Rings are some big, you know, tentpole type movies that I still look to for.
Oh, yeah.
Actual, like, good to me, like good writing and structure and things that just work, I think, on a really emotional level. And I think that James Cameron, and I'm sure that Avatar is like this too, like from what I've heard, but like, you know, it works on an emotional level and that's why people get into it. They're moved by it. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. It's not my, like, aesthetically, I couldn't get past the look of it. Like, it just looks so, it looks like vomit to me. But I believe mm-hmm. that some people really tap into it emotionally, and I'm happy for them. I'm sure to have yeah. a great time.
And I'll say this, which is probably too late. If you like whatever you like, that's great. And I cheer you on. I actually don't really care that much. But the cycle of the group chats that everyone has of like what you should like or what you should be into or why this was the best thing they've ever seen. I mean, we also just live yeah. in this world of like hyperboles and superlatives and stuff, and where it's just
yeah.
everything is the savior. And
yeah,
I don't know. I think the content glut has a lot to do with it. So I'm looking forward yeah. to whatever happens
less
in this
stuff.
New. Yeah, well, and I don't want like anyone to have less work or less jobs, but I do. I think when there's like more focus, it probably helps. I don't know.
Yeah.
If you like no. the fact that it took this long for Shogun to come out, I'm sure it's going to be good because there's a lot of stuff that was important to get right.
Look, I will not. Yeah, I'm really interested to think to see what people think about it because it's like, you know, I'm so in it at this point. But it's interesting because it's also not mine necessarily. I have a soft spot for it because it was my first job, but. Yeah,
well, you did two episodes, right?
I did. I
that's not nothing.
Yes, my name is on two episodes of yeah. Shogun. So yeah, I mean it is it's a big deal. It's just strange because you know now people are talking about it and it's like it's a wild. I'm just getting. It's my first time you know going through all this, having something out there in the world for TV, and it's so strange because I feel like so far away from. The actual process of writing it, but everybody's going to be discovering it for the first time and kind of have to like see it with fresh eyes again. It's very, very strange way to work.
Well, I think the big thing about this, which is definitely what happens in a lot of movies and TV stuff now, is like, what will be the culture shock or like the meme things that pop up from it? Cause I mean, yeah. you know, the best example is things like Succession, right? The season finale, series finale of Succession. Wasn't watched by like a gajillion billion people. It was, I don't know, I think it was like 4 million, which is still yeah. a lot. But the amount of like the general culture that had heard about it and was talking about it, the Laura Piana shoes that were moving, like all of the like quiet luxury stories that started happening, like all these like ripple yeah. effects about a show that not everyone had seen, but had affected the culture, I think is
yeah.
some of the most interesting things of like modern television. And I'll be really... Like what sort of like, I mean, I know this is like a it's a period era, but like what sort of like Japanese fashion stuff's going to pop up? Like what sort of, you know, like memes are going to come from this? Like, is that a discussion that's ever mentioned in the writers' rooms? Like, is like, you know, I don't know.
It's hard with something like this, like thinking about it in terms of memes. I mean, I really, and I have more appreciation for this now that I've been in other rooms, but like, it's kind of wild. You would never guess this probably from watching the show, but like how much we laughed in the room and how much like our understanding of certain characters came from just being very sort of like, just like joking about, like there's a character in it, in the book named Yabu, who we changed. A lot of the names we've changed from the book because James Clavell, God bless him, like wrote a lot of historical names into the book and some that don't exist in real life. So that character's name, Yabushige now, he's played by Tadanobu Asano, who some people might know from Ichi the Killer. He's fucking amazing. I love him in it. But like we, you know, this character in the book is sort of, he's kind of this like crusty old grump. He's sort of a villain. He's a little bit like the Littlefinger of the book. For Game of Thrones fans. And, you know, he's kind of gross in the book, but we were just like, what if he's hot? What if it's hot Yabu? We had a lot of fun just talking about like hot Yabu and then like thinking about new storylines in terms of like, he's got swag and he does in the show. Now he has some of the best costumes of anybody. And I was asking about this on the podcast to the costumer. I was like, surely you took some liberties with this like incredible, like black feathered shoulder piece Ooh. That he's wearing in the first episode. It's so cool looking. It's just like, it's such an entrance of the character. You're like, this guy really cares about how he looks. And that says something about him. But he was like, no, in this era, which is like before the Tokugawa era, which is like kind of the classic samurai era. Mm-hmm. It was kind of before things got really regimented and there was like a really set way that people dressed and the, you know, so many aspects of life got really prescribed. But before that, in this feudal era, people were really like going for some real looks. Like there was drip in like the Sengoku era, which is when this takes place. And that was cool, really cool to learn about. Like, yeah, but that, I mean, costume moments, I would say that's definitely one. And that's in the first episode. It's really, really fucking cool. There's some haircuts that I think are pretty amazing. There's a character named Fuji who has a haircut that I was like, could I pull that off? It's got like these really tiny little short bangs that like end at the eyebrow. And yeah. it's just a really cool look. But like, yeah, I don't know. I'm sure that people will find memes. And it's like almost not for me to think about that. Like that's other sure. people's jobs. But there's a lot in it. Like there's so much stuff in it that I'm sure people will find things to, you know, just graft me onto. in the memes. I sound ancient. But yeah.
No, I mean that I like really live for that stuff. I think too, especially where when you see a lot of these things, like it affects the runway, like it affects, I mean, and it truly does, into which, you know, I have a few friends who work at fashion houses and they have to come up with a better story than what happened with the designer, where it would be like, this is not true, but this is just a, you know, example. It's like, oh, Demna was just really into watching Hackers and that's how the collection was formed. And it's like, okay, we got to come up with a better thing than that. You know, like
yeah.
Pharrell and LV, you know, like did dude just like find an old magazine and get into it, which is fine. And I think that's great. But like when you see how these things that people make really do affect, like have this ripple effect across like fashion and culture, it, I don't know. I get really, really excited about that.
Do you think, like, I am always interested in that. How many collections though seem like at least they're, the liner notes say that they're inspired by a certain movie or something. Like as a movie person, I'm always like really into that. And then sometimes you're like, okay, I think I know what this collection is going to look like. And then it totally defies expectations. I'm thinking of like, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about Alexander McQueen lately for some reason. Mm. Actually, no, I know the reason.
Deep cut. Okay.
Well, I mean, he used to do a lot of, his early things were just, he did a collection supposedly based on The Hunger, which is one of my favorite movies, the vampire mm-hmm. movie from 1983 with Catherine Deneuve in it. And which I've totally done as a Halloween costume before. It was very, very, mountaintop moment for me as far as Halloween costumes go. But yeah, you look at it and you're like, I love to see how this was reflected through your brain, because it's not like they're dressed up like the vampires in the movie. They're not wearing like Armani suits or whatever. It's like something kind of more structural and impressionistic, but still kind of feels like the movie. It has the temperature and the color of the movie in a way. And I just think that stuff is so, I love to see how people interpolate film and TV into other works.
Yeah, I mean, a friend of mine's a designer, and one of his collections was based around New Jack City. And, you know, and he was transparent about it. Yeah. He was like, yeah, like this is yeah. one of the things that inspired me. And you know, it gets into interesting stuff too, especially when you look at like now costume designers, you know, they don't own their IP. So like they don't really get right. to benefit from that, which is like a whole other yeah. discussion we could get into another time. But like, when you think of how that stuff plays out and how these films affect that, I mean, the amount of people that got into the drapey sort of 1980s, all the designers that were like rewatching American Gigolo, right? Because they're like, man, mm-hmm. old Armani, 80s Armani, and you see it. And this is the stuff where, like, I'm not saying you need to be on TikTok, but you see how this like ripples down into which you see like a large, large company, say like a Bonobos or a Buck Mason, and they're referencing like oversized sport coats, which is like half pulled from TikTok and then half pulled from, you know, some influencer who did that, where, you know, someone's like, hey, here's the 10 things you need to search for on eBay to get this look. And you see like, yeah. oh, this is fashion now. It's this like amalgamation of, you know, like what is the source? Like, what is the source of the big stuff? Was it Demna doing oversized looks? Was it this writer? Was it Rachel Tashjian? Like, or is it the combination of everything? I don't know.
I think about this. I think especially like that era, because it's so back right now, or maybe we're mm-hmm. on the cusp of ending the reworking of that sort of early 80s American Gigolo type era. I follow so many interior design Instagrams that are just like, there's like a big one called Cocaine Decor that's like very of that vibe. Yeah. But I think about this a lot because I'm just like, does everything have its turn to come back? And it has to be mm-hmm. found by the right person who can contextualize it in a new way. I think about, like, I mean, just to reference another early 80s thing, like, there are all these like kids react to videos, and there's the one of the kids reacting to In the Air Tonight. And, yeah. you know, when the drums come in, they're just like, oh, and it's really great. Like, it's so joyful if you love that song already. And then you're like really happy to see somebody else loving it. But like, there's something completely just, you know, immaterial, but just sort of spiritual about that. Oh, sound is going to be how we understand Miami Vice now, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like that is the framework through which a new generation is going to like reprocess this aesthetic, make it, you know, it's never like a one-to-one thing, but it's just like, you know, how do you make it feel like now? And I kind of wonder what the next thing is going to be. Cause it feels like, I mean, to me, it's like, I could watch any old movie and then be like, okay, this is fashion. Like, find something in it that, like, okay, I'm going to go on eBay and try to find something like this.
Well, what was the last time that happened for you?
I recently watched, I got this Blu-ray ages ago, and I hadn't watched the movie itself in forever, but The Red Shoes, the Paul and Pressburger movie about, like, the ballerina, which is just, and it's less about fashion or one thing I would wear in it, but it's more like, it's the aesthetic. And I hadn't watched it in forever, and there's this extended ballet sequence in it that is just like, it's unlike it. Like, I mean, it's the reason to watch the movie. I think personally, like, the rest of the movie is like, okay, but the ballet is the thing to watch it for. And it's just like, if I was a fashion designer, which I'm not, but like, I would watch that and be like, just instantly a zillion ideas just from how, you know, the curtains flow, or like the tone of the gold in this one scene, or so, you know, just like, there's just so many visual ideas in it. There's like a moment where she's like dancing with like this male dancer sort of dressed up like a newspaper. And it's like, and the whole tone of that sequence is like this sort of gold. Yeah. This like golden sepia color. It's not like they changed it in post. It's like the set was designed that way. And it's just, it's so, yeah, it's just really inspiring. And it's like, you know, I don't know, if I was a TikTok teen too, I'm just like, okay, maybe I would like take that and dissect that on my, I don't know what they fucking do, but like, you know, I would take that and be like, okay, here's
10 ways to get the look from.
Yeah. Or like, I'll tell you why this is cool, or narrate it and do the all for everything. And like, you know, which I do, like, I was watching it and I was thinking that like every 10 seconds, I was like, holy shit, like biting my fist and shit. But but it takes the right person to do that. Like, and somebody has to have the je ne sais quoi to bring that into the present day and make people excited about it.
Yeah. Red Shoes is an interesting movie, because like that movie, Spielberg and Scorsese and George Lucas all talk about how it's the movie that got them into filmmaking, other than Lawrence of Arabia. But like, mm-hmm. the coloring of that movie, like, I don't know. It's like a certain, I don't know if it's like a Panavision.
It's
or whatever,
a Technicolor. It's yeah. one of the like classic Technicolor. Yeah. And they just know how to work with color. So I'm a big fan of Black Narcissus. That's my favorite of theirs. That's probably yep. one of my top 10 movies of all time. But like, they just know how to use color in a way that, yeah, you can't really, I don't know what it, I'm not enough of a technical person to know what it is about Technicolor that makes things look like that. Like just so like reds just look creamy. Like, it looks like you can bite yeah. into things. That they really know how to use it. And that film is probably like the best just for that.
What was the last thing that you were searching for on eBay that like you got inspired for that made you pull out your phone and go on eBay?
I've been actually like going insane on eBay lately and looking for just sort of idly searching for things that I won't even actually get.
What's your watch list?
I just cleared off a bunch of stuff, I will say, because it was just getting overly crowded. I have, okay, I'm on my watch list right now, and there's a reason for this. I have two Watanabe Comme des Garçons dresses that I didn't get. And I have a very Japanese watching, right? Because I have a vintage Seiko high beat watch that I've wanted one like it for a very long time. So I'm just watching one of those. And I have a Pleats Please Miyake dress on there that I'm not going to get, but whatever. I just bookmarked it.
I watched so many things. I'm like, yeah, I'm not buying this.
Yeah. Yeah. I, a lot of my clothes buying and searching, I love searching for things to wear for an event. I love to have a thing to plan an outfit for. It's like one of the, I'm not a super shopper or what, I'm not a shopaholic or anything, but if there's something that I am, that I can like envision and sort of almost like art direct for a specific event, then I get very excited about that. I love to plan out ahead of time things. So I had this idea that I was going to try to find some like vintage Comme des Garçons or Miyake for the Shogun premiere.
Right.
And then ended up getting, and there was a lot of things I found, but it was like, nothing was like sticking out to me. And then I found a 1997 vintage Alexander McQueen dress from the It's a Jungle Out There collection. And I like got chills from looking at it, and it was too expensive, but I was like, I can't not get it. It's like, it's going to be the one. There's nothing that's going to make me feel this happy. It's supposed to actually come in today. I'm anxiously checking my shop app, but yeah, I mean that, you know, there are certain things that are like that is just very sentimental to me. Just like, I was obsessed with McQueen when I was in high school. I mean, and beyond too, but that was like just a real touchstone for me then. So, that's why I've been kind of on this kick. I was just like going back and looking at that show, and then I just go down a whole wormhole at everything. But yeah, I was just, I had that tab open forever and was just like, oh, I gotta pull the trigger on it. Like,
yeah, I've done that, into which like I had to delete eBay from my phone because my screen time isn't really so much on social media. It's usually eBay, specifically at night. I am in bed.
Oh, yeah.
And I have all these different dumb searches. And occasionally, because I started also using HiBid, which is more for estate sale stuff, because I like collect a lot of watches. It's funny you mentioned Seiko. Like King Seiko's like, well, I just say this because like they've like gone way, way up. Because you also have, King Seiko is basically the in-between of Grand Seiko and Seiko.
Grand Seiko.
And so, yeah, you had all these like nutty, nutty movements.
The HiBid is the one that I'm like coveting right now. Yeah. Yeah. I went, I had a very fun trip. Well, I mean, the trip itself wasn't fun, but I was in Tokyo like right after Japan opened back up.
Oh, did you go to the Seiko Museum?
I did. Oh, no, I didn't go to the Seiko Museum, but I got my first watch. I did get a Grand Seiko. I got a Lady Snowflake there, which is a big deal. and I got it like at the store, like, you know, they gave me the whole presentation when I walked out, you know, there were 10 people at the door saying goodbye and bowing to me. It was like, wow, I feel like I bought a car. I have to say, like, the only reason I wasn't able to do that is that the exchange rate was ridiculous at that moment, between Japan and the States. But I was also there on a mission to get a vintage Seiko for, a friend of mine who was also a big Seiko head. And so that's kind of what was my gateway into looking into them, is because I was trying to find one for him. And I went to like the spot for getting them, which is just in this mall that I loved. I was going to go to this mall anyway that has a bunch of vintage shops in it. But there's a huge, huge watch shop there that also has like a big online presence. It's just, but I would just spent like half the day there just looking at everything and trying to find something for him, and like on WhatsApp, just back and forth, and sending pictures like, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? It was
so
a lot
cool.
of fun. If anybody ever wants me to do that for them, if you have a watch in mind and next time I'm in Japan, I love to be a personal shopper for people.
How often do you go?
I've been going like every couple years or so.
Okay.
And then I didn't go for a while.
I'm going in the spring.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I mean, I'm probably going to go sometime this year. I sort of have to, just for family reasons. But
oh, okay.
Yeah, I hadn't gone in a bit just because of COVID and everything else. But so that was like, as soon as they opened up, I was like, I have to go out and see my grandma and stuff. But I happened to have just sold a pitch then. So I was like, I get a little present. And that was my present to myself.
That's awesome. That's a very like, if you know, you know, watch too. I feel like you'll see a dude wearing
a $500,000 Patek Philippe and you get like the head nod of someone wearing like a specifically like the Snowflake. Like the Snowflake is such a great watch. But I don't know. I hope you find that. But go on Hybid.
Yeah.
Because like that's where I go, where people have like old Longines, old Seikos, King Seikos, Grand Seikos that are on there. And
I'm looking at a Longines on Real right now that I'm just like, I hope nobody gets this before me. Yeah, I need to sell something else and then I'll get it.
Yeah, I even made the mistake once, and this was like literally 2 days ago. There was this Patek 3404 that was on there, which is like anything from like the 70s-ish. It was kind of like this lost art and where I think things were a little bit like easier to afford if you're trying to collect. Like most vintage collectors go for like the 40s to the 60s. And so I was like, oh, this is this cool watch on there. It looks like it's going to go for, you know, like $2,000, and it's a, you know, $18,000 watch. And so I messaged a friend of mine who's a vintage dealer, and I messaged him and was like, hey, I found this watch. I think it's worth a ton. Like the hands look original. It looks unpolished. And he messaged me back and he's like, yeah, he's like, I'll find someone to buy it right now. He's like, buy it. And he's like, I'll go in on it with you. As long as it's less than this, we can make some money off of it. Let's do it. And I called the auction house. It was in Virginia. And I called him and I was like, hey, I wanted to bid on this. Wanted to list as an absentee. And he's like, okay. So I sent in my regular bid. And he's like, well, he's like, just so you know, he's like, this is only going to go for the floor. So call in at this time. I'm like, okay. So I call in at the time.
Shit.
Yeah, I call in at the guy when he tells me to call in. And they said, and it was a different person. And I was like, hey, this, you know, Eric, whatever, told me to call in at this time to bid on the Patek Philippe. And they were like, oh, you just missed it. It was an hour ago. And it went for like $2,200. And that watch is $20,000. And so,
oh my God.
So my theory, because I told my friend, he's like, oh, he's like shady dude. He's like, I guarantee you the guy that you talked to gave you the wrong time because he probably knew it or like brought someone else in so he could backdoor it and like make more money off the watch.
Did he? And he knew what your bid was going
to
be?
Well, yeah, because I told him, I was like, I'm going to bid.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, I'm going to bid this. I was like, I'm prepared to go up to this number. And he was like, and he was like, oh yeah, cool. He's like, you just need to call in at that time. And I was like, wait, is this common? And my friend who's the watch dealer was like, oh yeah, this is super common. He's like, next time that happens, he's like, ask to speak to like this type of person because they don't know enough. And like, they're just going to tell you when to call in. He's like, you know, he's like, basically you just can't trust anyone in the watch stuff because he thinks that the main guy that I called basically like knew it was some hot thing that was in this estate sale and purposely gave me the wrong time. I have the email from him where he's like, yep, call in at this time for the bid. And so
that's a new career for you. You got to be the guy in charge of the auction because then
auctions are
the game is rigged
shit shows. Yeah. They're totally rigged. But it made me so mad. But like that's my late night thing where I just sit and I find weird clothes or weird watches or stuff to get.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're finally at this era where even like some of the stuff from the Emmy carpet where people are like, oh, what are you wearing? And someone was like, oh, I'm wearing, you know, 2002 Chanel. And people are like, oh, how sustainable of you? And
it's like, yeah. But I mean, I think like as a person who's not one good, I mean, I have actually used like, I know somebody who does fashion placement for events and stuff. So I have used her before and she does like sustainable underrepresented designers, that kind of thing, which is cool. It's cool to, you know, support that stuff. But like otherwise, if I'm going to an event, like, and I want to wear something nice and I'm not going to be getting free clothes from anybody. Like vintage to me is just the way to go. And then it's just, and then you actually have to know something, which is just in general, that's why I appreciate vintage shopping, but like, especially for getting something special for an event. Like, it's just, I don't know. It's just more special to me than getting something off the rack. I don't even know the last time I got something just off the rack. I am like, I almost never buy anything full price ever.
Anything new like, or anything full price?
I buy new things, but full price for sure. But I generally like, you know, even if it's something that I, you know, like like a pair of Levi's or something that isn't even that expensive, I'll still be on eBay being like, can I find this better? So like I'm just habitually a deal person. So yeah.
When was the last time you searched for Levi's? Because Levi's on eBay now are like $150.
Yeah, I know. It's ridiculous. I mean, I am on the Real World a lot. That's okay. A place I have a lot of stuff bookmarked. And that is, I'm always a little shocked by it. I mean, there's only a few cuts of Levi's that I really like, so I'm always just looking for those. But everybody else discovered what I know, which is that should never TikTok. Pay more than a cost. Is it fucking TikTok, man?
It's TikTok.
They ruined everything. No,
they did.
But they ruined estate sales in LA. I don't know if you know about that. Like it's. I used to be a huge estate sale person in LA, and now you just can't go. Like it's not worth it. You're just gonna. It's just so crowded and stressful. But there was a real heyday of me going to estate sales and finding some amazing shit, some really good clothes too. But yeah, I don't know. It's got to be all invaluable, real for me now. I'm not leaving my house.
Well, I'm sure in Iowa, you probably got a pretty good pick. Supposedly the best vintage is in Iowa.
Who said that?
Todd Snyder from Iowa.
Okay. I mean, I love shopping for vintage clothes in Iowa. I mean, it is less picked over, but like,
yeah, I don't think you're going to find, you know, McQueen out there.
No, but I do get some good stuff. And I mean, like, that's how I grew up, was going to like the Mennonite thrift store that I grew up going to is still in operation. It's in a different building, but it's still like, I'm still getting my clothes from Crowded Closet. You know, I'm still, going to, there's like a mostly house goods type stuff that's in downtown mm-hmm. Iowa City that's been there since I was a kid, and that's still the coolest shit to me. Like, I haven't outgrown that or anything. Getting house stuff is great. Home decor here is, you can get amazing antiques, you can get, you know, cool art and everything for stuff that would be like three times the price in LA or New York. So that's a big plus to decorating a home out here.
I bought a bunch of old Bertoia chairs from this estate sale down the street from me. And the guy wanted, I don't know, he wanted like 25 for each chair. And they're like, $500, $600 a chair. I mean, I was like,
What he had?
No, I told him, I was like, these are really nice. I was like, I'll give you this much for it. You know, I mean, I had to clean them. I had to get like a toothbrush or whatever and just clean all the dust. I mean, because they're like, you know, it's the mesh, steel mesh thing. So I'm like cleaning. Mm-hmm. I mean, they sat in a, I don't know, smoke-filled basement for decades. So they smelled like crap and I had to clean them all up, and that took hours. But yeah, I got like these really nice, you know, sick Bertoia chairs.
Awesome.
Yeah, like next to nothing. But I don't need them. But in my head, I was like, I was telling my wife, I was like, yeah, I bet I could sell these. I'll put them on Etsy. I can, you know, I mean, I'm such a freaking like college dropout where it's just like, I'm always like, I bet I could do this. I bet I can figure this out, you know? And my wife's like, I don't know. You're going to sell chairs online?
I barely get as far as like, I could fix this up and then, you know, then it's worth the $250, the gap between what it's worth and what the, you know, I can sometimes do that math and justify it. But a lot of times I'm just like, the stress of trying to flip something is, it's not like my house. I'm not, everybody's like, are you flipping that house? You know, is this an investment problem? I'm like, no. This is my house. I'm going to live here like a normal person. Like not everything is a flip. Everything is like a grift here, but yeah.
Yeah, those are the LA folks. It's got to be. Because even then when people, like when I got the house here, people were like, that's such a great idea to get an investment place outside. And I was like, no, this is just where I'm going to be. So
yeah.
And I'm locked in with interest rates, somewhere. So I'm not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're not going anywhere, which is fine. Like I am very invested in making this house like kind of a jewel. Like it's not the biggest place in the world, but I just want I always say it's like the right size for me to wrap my head around, especially somebody who's only lived in apartments her entire life. Like, that I can really plan it out and sort of, it's like art directing something. It's like, you know, directing a film, and you have people who are doing work for you, and you have to be really specific about what you want, and things can go wrong. And I'm learning, like, it is actually so much like directing, at least my experience of directing shorts and stuff like that. And I almost feel like I'll be a better director after working on the house, just because it's such an undertaking.
Yeah, you're in control, but you're basically powerless at the same time.
Yeah. And if you don't have a good relationship with the people who are working with you, then things can go sideways. Yeah. And then you realize the value of being, I mean, you know, not everybody has the opportunity to do this, but like if you are back in a place where you have a connection or you know people going way back, like those little helping hands can just come back in. And it's not even necessarily a small town thing. I think it's just any place where you have like people and a history. Yeah, it's nice.
It's great. Well, anyway, I've taken up a ton of your time. Thank you. Thank you so much for this. It was great to meet you. You've been listening to Blammo. Our show is produced by Blammo Media. We're edited by Amar Lowell, and our theme music, as always, by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. If you like what you heard, you know the drill. Share the pod with a friend. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Give us 5 stars or thumbs up on whatever other thing you're listening to us on, whether it's Dingledorf or Bing Bong, whatever it's called. But you can also follow us on Instagram for all the hot content. If you want to talk to us and give us your hot take, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email at info@blammopod.com. Last but not least, super ultra important, if I had an air horn, I would press it right now. You got to come and join us over on Patreon, because the fun never stops over there. Look, the live show, the free show, whatever you want to call this, we take breaks here and there, but Patreon, it never stops. And we also got exclusive shows like Die Workwear, hosted by Derek Guy and Peter Zatolo, and the Triple J Show, hosted by yours truly with John Moy and Gene DeLeon. There's just a ton of stuff over there. So check it out at patreon.com/blammo. If not, no worries. We got hundreds and hundreds of free episodes in the feed and more to come. So we will see you all soon.